You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Monster Talk is the science show about monsters, but in this episode, we continue our mini-series on magic. In our last episode, we began a two-part interview on grimoires, books of magic, in Western European tradition, with Jerry Drake, a data scientist and former professor who now works for the U.S. State Department. As a reminder, the comments and information Jerry talks about in this episode are based on his own research, and he's not here representing any official government position about these topics. If you haven't heard part one of this interview, I'd urge you to go back and listen to that first, but just in case you missed it, in that portion of the interview, we contextualize the grimoire that one sees in horror films, TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and in fiction such as the Necronomicon, as being primarily a construct of the 18th and 19th century in Europe. We talked about how the majority of the books were not diabolic in nature, but rather used magic as an extension of Judeo-Christian tradition, and that magic was essentially a technology. Prior to the ascension of the scientific method for filtering out what technologies actually work from those which only sometimes seem to work, most scholars with the means to assemble a library would have included some books of magic and esoterica alongside their natural science collection without seeing this as a clashing approach to understanding the world. So now let's hop into part two of our interview with Jerry Drake. You're listening to
Monster Talk.
Jerry, how does the grimoire interface with coded texts like the view of some holy books as seen by the Kabbalah?
Oh, my God. See, that's what's really interesting is grimoire, as we know them, are typically not particularly coded. They are actually there for you to interpret the information and to use it. And that's especially true of these books we might call leech books, which were really popular in the Anglo-Saxon world. If you ever get a chance to look up a leech book, let me see if I can remember a couple. Do I own one? Yeah. There's a couple of Anglo-Saxon leech books that are really weird. Leech comes from actual leech, the thing that locks onto you and sucks your blood. Leechers in the old days were doctors, right? So a leech book is a doctor book. These books had magic spells, recipes, chemical formulae that you could use to actually make poultices and boluses in order to cure people. And they weren't coded at all. A lot of them were based on Enochian magical traditions, but a lot of them were based on just trial and error, pre-scientific method. The same is true for our later folk magic books, Powwow Magic, The Long Lost Friend that the German Hexenmeisters used in places like Pennsylvania and the area I'm from in Central Texas and Goshen, Indiana, those kind of places. They were not meant to be coded books. They were meant to actually be taken down, read, and practiced. the Kabbalah, a lot of the Gnostic texts, unfortunately the very few that still survive that are in places like the Nag Hammadi Library or the Dead Sea Scrolls, are meant to be mysterious texts. They're meant to not be easily understandable. And then, of course, if you ever have a chance to look at an alchemical tractate, they're completely illegible. I mean, you would have to learn how to read the code that those things are written in order to understand them. And I think the most famous of those, whatever the hell it is the Voynich manuscript that's in the Beinecke Rick Book Library up in Yale University.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Okay, so I don't
know. Do you have any theories on the writing system? And
I have spent the better part of my years, when I want something to do, I take down the Voynich manuscript and play around with it. And I've put it through some of my computer software that we've done at work. I have very good friends in the community that have looked at this thing. It's often a book that a young signal Intel experts will take a look at. The theory that I have is that it does not contain natural language. And natural language is what the first thing that you're going to look for whenever you start to try to decode a cipher or something that's hidden. Probably one of the most famous examples of this are the Beale ciphers that are famous here in the U.S., where supposedly there's a treasure hidden in Northern Virginia by this guy, I think his name is John Beale, where he dug up all this gold and planted it, and there were three ciphers left behind, and one of them, the Declaration of Independence, could be used to transfer it. When we look at those other ciphers, we can tell that there's no natural language present. Someone is simply writing random scripts. When we look at the Zodiac text...
Wait. So you mean there's no treasure?
There's no treasure.
Dang it.
Yeah. The treasure was the money made from
selling the right, selling the treasure map.
Yeah,
the lucrative.
So whenever we look at the Zodiac text, however, there's natural language there. It follows the pattern of English grammar. We just can't fully decode what's there. The Voynich manuscript, if it contains natural language, it has to be probably Latin, rendered into a colloquial language, I think Italian, and then translated into the Voynich script. The reason why I think it might be Italian is because some of the illuminations in the book clearly show Italianate architecture that, again, you can identify if you spend enough time poking around. But I am not entirely convinced that the Voynich manuscript contains natural language. And
but you don't think it's a hoax as such?
I think it is a hoax, but I think it's okay. A medieval hoax. A lot of these books are hoaxes. A lot of grimoire, a lot of these magic books were things that printers and scholars at the time just flat made up to make a buck. And you could go, hey, look at what I've got here. I've got this famous, text by, Hermes Trismegistus. I found it, in this monastery in Poland, and I've translated it into Latin and I've translated it into Italian, and you can buy it from me, to have in your palatial library, Enrique Sforza. And I think that's what this thing was. And there's a lot of examples of that. Have you guys heard of the Codex Gigas?
Yes.
It's this giant book. It's really stupid looking. It's this enormous book. It was clearly made by somebody who was in the laity, not a real scholastic bookmaker. And it's got a picture of the devil in it. It's called the Devil's Bible by some people. And it was probably created just so that monastery could have a really cool book. And that's the way it worked. Like, if you had a cool occult book in your famous library, you would pour some port or some, brandy and bring the fire and brimstone boys over to the house and bring them down to the library and show this stuff off. And every library, if you read, M.R. James is kind of one of my scholastic inspirations. If you read his stuff, one of the things he was really interested in was cataloging old libraries. And he would always find 25, 30 really rare occult books in every library that he went to look at. And that's certainly true because these things were considered cool by standards of the day. I mean, that's why I collect them, because they're cool, right? So that didn't change. So I think that the Voynich manuscript is probably along those lines.
Well, do you...
We know...
Okay. Do we have enough market data about what things were going for at the time to see if there was more, like...
I you know, if I'd prepared for that, I have this information, but the Voynich manuscript was valuable in its day.
Yeah, that's what I was
like,
curious
it,
about.
It
yeah.
sold for some bucks. But, you know, an illuminated manuscript, like, in the Renaissance cost more than a year's income for an average person. I mean, I can't think of anything today that would sell that's so mundane. Like, we're talking about something that's the price of a car, you know, the price of a house to have some of these books. And some of the ones that sell today go for $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. And that's less than what they would have sold for at the time, just because the labor was so intensive. That's why movable type in the Gutenberg revolution was so important, because it made reading available to a market that a nouveau riche market that previously only the wealthiest people in society could afford.
That is awesome.
When we were just talking a little bit earlier about science and modern books today, historically with these earlier texts, did the written word have particular credibility for the general public? The way that books are seen today, they're seen as being gospel. If something's written in a book, it's often seen as having credibility. Is it the same perspective that people had historically about these books?
So this is something, this actually is something I dealt with in my dissertation work. So we're sort of swinging back here. The written word has always had more credibility than the spoken word because of the permanence of it. And the idea in the Middle Ages, you don't forget, you know, we had this period of Roman rule that lasted over 1,000 years, where Rome defined the Hellenistic and the European universe. And then in China, you had a series of dynastic empires that lasted for thousands of years, dynastic empires in Egypt, dynastic empires in Japan. And when those falter, one of the first things that was lost in the ancient world was the ability to read and write. So writing and reading have always been considered elitist and intellectual and esoteric. During the what we call the Great Dark Age of the ancient world, when the Hellenistic world faltered and Greek colonies sort of rose to power, that was the time period when the Homerian epics were first said and began to be written down. Writing had faltered. So there's always been this idea that the past had better knowledge, they had better ideas, they had better access to skills and writing ability, and being able to read that knowledge somehow made you smarter, better, and more intelligent. So by necessity, writing has always carried with it a level of authority that speaking didn't have. And I think that was true right up until the great information revolution that we are experiencing now. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember Alvin Toffler, who everybody in the world read back in the 70s.
The third wave?
Third wave. And he postulated that we would get to a point where the average human being would consume so much information they wouldn't be able to handle it, and they would short out. And what we've actually discovered is that the opposite is true. We're so bombarded with information now that we just pick what we want, right? Like, if I don't like the idea that global warming's real, I can go to a website and find something that looks like a scientific paper that says it's not. Or if I don't like X thesis or X idea or the idea that evolution is real, I can go to Answers in Genesis and I can find me a cited paper that says that, you know, the universe was created in 6 days, blah, blah, blah. And the Grand Canyon is absolute proof of that. So we still appeal to authority based on the written word, even in this area where information is supposed to be completely democratized.
This actually came up this morning on my morning walk. I was thinking about the difference between cults and religions. And a lot of cults come and go, or they, you know, survive 5, 10, 15 years. And they're really tied up with a personality. And it's not so much about whether their belief system is fringy or not. It's more about this piece that's missing. Most cultists don't take the time to codify their belief system into a giant written text.
Right.
And so you can sort of end up with this sort of survivor fallacy where the religions that don't make it don't have texts that survive, right? So there's very few large world religions which lack a big system of written records. And I was wondering about that. Maybe these other religions would be just as long-lasting if they had bothered to build up a text base, you know, is that lasting ability to share your ideas beyond the life of the leader.
I was just saying, just like L. Ron Hubbard, I was just thinking about Scientology and as a cult that has been raised as a religion to a religion by
with
some.
Lots of words on paper, right?
That's the problem, yeah, though, is that maybe if your text base is so boring, you know, like Ron Hubbard's is, you might not be able to get through it. But no, you're absolutely right. You know, someday when I retire, I want to write a book called The Most Valuable Book in the World. And I want to write about sort of the most important missing manuscripts in history. And one of those would be the manuscript that the New Testament is based on. It's called the Q source, which is German for Quelle, which just means source, the source. And it was a book of sayings that the Synoptic Gospels was essentially based on. So this would have been, there's a book of sayings, of Jesus sayings in the Quran. The Q source was probably along those lines. And it would have just been verbatim stuff that the prophet we know as Jesus would have said. And as we know, the Synoptic Gospels were all written a couple of centuries after Jesus died, if he even lived at all. I'm one of those weirdos that doesn't even think he needed to exist in order to be the basis for a religion. Well, I mean, to write a book about somebody based on the written word, that would be like us writing a biography of George Washington or, somebody even older than that, George I of England, without having any written sources, just by asking people who lived in his town what he was like. So the Q source is a tremendously important manuscript. And you're absolutely right. That's the reason why we don't still practice Mithraism, which is a religion that looked very much like Christianity and probably influenced Christianity, because they were such a mystery cult, they never wrote anything down. And the same is true of the great Celtic and Germanic religions. Most of the stuff that we know about what we call the Woden religion was written down by Christians. What we know about the ancient Celtic faith, what people know about the Druidic faith is only known by the people who conquered those folks. Caesar in his chronicles, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, some of those kind of books. So because we don't have a preservation of those texts, we kind of have to make one up if we want to pretend to be Woden worshipers now, or, you know, Druids in the modern world. And that's certainly what, I mean, I hate to Godwin the thread, but, you know, that's certainly what Hitler did. You know, he wanted to go back to the old Germanic religion. Well, nobody ever wrote it down, so we'll just found the Annenurbe and invent our own. And on a much nicer side of that pancake, that's what Wicca is. You know, you had people who got a real interest in ancient English and Britannic and Celtic religion and formed a new faith out of that. And that's what Asatru is in Iceland and in the Nordic countries. It's an attempt to sort of resurrect these old religions, but they don't have a text in hand. And I think you're absolutely right. That's why I think even us skeptics go kind of, I mean, we do it too. We sort of look at them sideways and go, oh, you're not real because you're not rooted in this sort of ancient tradition. And you're absolutely right. It's because the ancient tradition wasn't written. So they don't have a text that they can go to show this tie to them.
I mean, I don't know what we have left of the Babylonians' religion, but I mean, obviously it gets mentioned a lot in the Bible. I assume it was a full,
sure,
rich, you know, well-developed religion, but I just, you know, it doesn't... there's so many lost religions that probably had their own interesting takes on everything. I guess I don't want this to get into a giant religious discussion, but it seems like to tie it back to grimoires... It all ties back together that you know, Karen's a linguist. She knows what I'm talking about. Language is our best way of sharing ideas, and written language, it seems to be the best way of preserving those ideas. But even those get morphed over time. So,
well, we can't read Rapa Nui text. Obviously, we still don't know what the Moai were all about. So we can read Rapa Nui, we won't know. Easter Island. We can't read Minoan Crete, the earliest version of that. So the whole bull worship faith, we don't know anything about that. And then you have all these traditions where it just wasn't written down. I mean, probably the one that bugs me the most is over in Asia Minor. You have these places where we were building standing stone monuments years and years before civilization was traditionally thought to even begun. That was clearly a religious movement. The Pictish language, what little we have of it on their standing stones has never been interpreted. So there is actually a whole universe of culture and religion out there that we know about that we have no idea what it meant. And I think you're exactly right. The big three, you know, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and if we add in Buddhism, you know, have all been preserved because they have a rich written tradition. The thing that I find interesting are sort of those what I call occult traditions that hang on to the side. Kabbalah, Gnosticism, these were competing versions of those faiths at the time, and they didn't win. You know, if you know, Gnosticism had won out over Catholicism, we would live in a very different Western tradition right now. And at one time, Gnosticism was probably the more ascendant version of the Jesus movement, but they handled things differently. They didn't value procreation the way
sort of sideline. If your religion requires you not to reproduce, that's a bad way to propagate. Yeah.
You're not a growth industry. So, and that's exactly true. So, I mean, if we could, you know, this is why history is not a science, because we can't go back to then and rerun the experiment and see what would happen if, you know, Rome had adopted the Gnostic version of the faith instead of the version that was on offer in Rome. So, yeah, but you're right. And the whole concept of Kabbalah is founded on the power of the word. I mean, the very first phrase in the Bible resorts to the power of the word as spoken by God. In fact, the whole concept of the name of God in Judaism as a word of power, as a magical symbol, is invested in Jewish tradition. And if you read the Mishnah, you know, the various tractates that make it up, that's what they're all about, you know, is playing around with words, playing around with language. They were extremely keen on understanding how powerful language is. And it's not really until the 20th century when philosophers start to grapple with that. You know, does thought precede language? Does language precede thought? I mean, obviously, Karen probably knows more about this than I do, but you know, the concept.
Oh, it's not my specific area, but certainly, yeah. I wanted to ask another question, but I should let you finish first.
No, go right ahead. But yeah, I just want to underscore that's exactly right. Grimoires were seen as manuals. Other occult books were seen as technology in themselves.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the language of these magical texts. And
sure.
We talked a bit about the Voynich manuscript and how that's probably an artificial language of some kind. And if I can plug a book that I wrote a number of years ago, Language, Myths, Mysteries and Magic, I write in there about how with a lot of folk medicine, books about folk medicine and curses and things like that, they were often written in dead languages like Etruscan or Latin. And often gibberish was used instead, just rhyming language, things that sounded pseudo-Latin were often deemed to be magical and to be powerful words. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about the kinds of language that were used in these grimoires.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, I having come up in that sort of Seventh-day Adventist charismatic Pentecostal tradition, glossolalia is a big thing. You know, as they say, if you ain't got tongues, you ain't got nothing. So the whole idea is that you would sort of be possessed by the power of the spirit, and then you would start to babble off in languages you had never spoken. That phenomenon is called glossolalia, you know, to start just blabbing off in stuff that sounds like some ancient dead language. And I think that adds to the concept of the mystery. Somebody, I can't remember who, maybe it was even on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, said that Latin is the natural language of magic. And I think that's true. Latin, as we speak it, to say magical stuff just sounds cool. And we've all been primed for that, right? Like, you know, you go back and watch a movie like The Dunwich Horror and Henry Armitage starts to yell out and he's speaking in some foreign language, you know, and it's always Latin. And, you know, that's one of the things that always disappoints me about old Dennis Wheatley novels is that he says all the magical incantations in English and they sound really cheesy, you know.
Do you think it has something to do with just even religion and the church and exorcisms being performed in Latin? And
let me ask you this. Does opera sound better in German and Italian or English? Like there's something about it when you don't understand the words.
Exoticness.
It's got an exotic next to it. And that's exactly right. It's esoteric. But for the most part, Latin was the lingua franca of Europe for the entire Roman period and in the entire Middle Ages. I mean, they had to have a common language, the way English is, you know, God help us, the common language of the world today, whether you, you know, sort of like that or not. Latin was the language of the world for a long, long time. So most books were written in Latin or a form of Latin as a way to have a universal way of communicating. Latin, you know, as we studied, or I studied it in college and in undergrad, you know, was Roman Latin, High Latin from the Roman imperial period as written down. So I could take down a book today, you know, Caesar's Chronicles, and it would be legible to anybody who had had high school Latin. Medieval Latin, especially late medieval Latin, doesn't look like Latin at all. In fact, the alphabet barely looks like Latin, even though it's the same alphabet that we use to write English today, because Latin, like all languages, evolved. You know, if we were to go back 300 years, English wouldn't sound like English as we speak it today, you know. And in fact, I spent a lot of time working on Icelandic and Old English, and the crossovers, the deltas between Icelandic and Old English are closer, I think, than modern English and Old English. And the same was true for Latin. A Roman emperor would not be able to read 13th century Latin. And the chief reason why is because the vocabulary had got much bigger, and the syntax of the language was modified to match the syntax of the language of the local speaker. So a monk in France writing in Latin was going to use French grammar using Latin words. A monk writing in northern Italy in the 10th century would use an Etruscan / Italian grammar with Latin words. A Sicilian monk would use a Sicilian / Italian grammar with Latin words. An English monk writing in Latin who had been trained in English in places like Oxford and Cambridge would use a really gross and disgusting English grammar to write Latin words. And it's almost indescribable. And in the 19th century, you had scholars, you know, again, we can harken back to M.R. James, who took the time to actually learn how to read Latin in its various verses. So when I sit down with a Latin text today, the first thing I do is go, okay, I've got a sentence. I don't have any periods because there's no periods. It's all a run-on sentence. So I've got to find sort of the breaks. I have to translate the individual words. Then I have to understand the grammar the author was trying to use and then reconstruct that text into something that I can read. That's very different from reading actual Roman Latin, in where the grammar rules actually follow the rules of grammar. So I think because of all that, to us in 2017, who don't have the benefit of having been trained in Latin and Greek and Hebrew and all that in the school system like, you know, people in the 19th century were, it seems even more weird, classical and antique. So it sort of adds to the mystery. And one of the most disappointing things in the world is when you actually translate these grimoires into English and see how boring, you know, boring they are. They actually sound much better when you read them in their original language.
I'm sure, yeah, that exotic element again.
So there's diabolic and non-diabolic texts, but what was actually in these books? What could you do with them? Like, what kind of spells are actually in there for you if you actually bother to find one?
You know, I feel like I've answered every one of these questions by being vague, and it's difficult because this is such a big topic. You know, I really wished the world was like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where for some reason a high school has an ancient, you know, rare book library, and there are only 5 grimoires. The reality is these things were super popular, and there are hundreds of them. And at the time, there were probably thousands. The reality is that in most grimoires, they're super mundane. I mean, there's a reason why H.P. Lovecraft invented the Necronomicon, because there's no grimoire out there, with the possible exception of the Grand Grimoire, that says what we in 2017 want it to say. And most of them follow a pretty standard pattern. The really basic ones, the stuff based on the Books of Moses, the powwow book, you know, that kind of stuff, the leech books, are just recipe books. you'll find a recipe for how to make beer. The next recipe will be how to purify yourself so you can go out under the full moon and have a male child as part of your pregnancy. Then the next one will be how to make a bolus to cure worms. And then the one after that will be how to summon a nature force to deal with a fairy who is turning your cow's milk into spoiled butter. Those are very, very basic folk magic grimoires. The more esoteric grimoires follow that same pattern. And they typically set up this huge set of rules that the magist has to follow to get ready to do the magic. You know, Aleister Crowley, whenever he was living at Bullskin House, spent in Scotland, spent something like 6 or 8 months getting ready to do his rituals. Some of these ritual magicians would have to spend a year or more purifying themselves, not engaging in sexual activity, eating a certain diet, wearing white clothing, all this stuff to get ready. So the book teaches the magist how to ready their mind and body for the ritual, and then it outlays the ritual. You might have to draw a magic circle. You might have to draw a bunch of magic figures. You have to bring certain stuff together to make a potion. You have to invoke various figures to the four winds. And they're always very, very difficult. There are things where you have to assemble certain moving pieces. You have to get some stuff together to do it. And my theory is if this stuff were easy to do, people would do it and then realize it didn't work. So in order to have a good grimoire, it had to be just plausible enough to sell, but just difficult enough to make it something that somebody wouldn't necessarily want to do. The Grand Grimoire, which is absolutely my personal favorite, I keep talking about it, literally teaches you how to summon Satan. And, you know, even as a broke college student back in the 90s, I was able to put together the junk I needed to summon Satan. Didn't work, but, you know, I think most people in the early 19th century would be so put off by the concept of summoning the devil that they wouldn't want to do it. But that's the typical way these grimoires break down. How to prepare your body and mind as a magus, and then the actual mechanics of performing the ritual. And then once the ritual is performed, it teaches you how to keep yourself safe whenever you're either wielding the natural forces or the diabolic forces.
So did you have a plan if it had worked? Like, what were you going to do with Satan if you pulled him up?
Probably ask for college money, because that's the thing I needed the most. I needed college money, I needed pearl beer, and I needed a place to stay. So we were going to knock that out first. We all had girlfriends at the time, so we weren't going in that direction. But mostly, you know, I mean, you only call up Satan when you need pretty basic stuff, right? So that was the plan. But he didn't show. One thing I want to say, though, and this freaks me out, Blake, the place where we did our ritual, I will not mention the names of my friends who joined me in this, but they are still Facebook friends of mine, and they will probably listen to this podcast, but they have respectable jobs now, was a place called Goatman's Bridge, north of Dallas in Alton, in Denton County. I went to the University of North Texas in Denton as my undergraduate college. Damn it all, if last year Zach Baggins didn't go there and do a demonic summoning himself, and it freaked us out. My sister saw it. I don't watch that damn show. My sister saw it. She lives right by there and said, I literally got a Facebook message where she said, hey, Zach Baggins is at that spot where he tried to summon a demon back in 1990. And we tuned in, we watched the episode, and it was like, wow, that was the exact spot. You know, I took a bunch of 110 photographs of that. I mean, we thought we were the Ghostbusters, you know. We brought out whatever cotton sack scientific equipment we had and you know, set up my dad's video camera and all this stuff. And we took it super seriously. I think I even put on a suit. It was totally ridiculous. So I was happy to see that I was Zach Baggins before it was cool.
Well, you had me wondering. I mean, is it possible that you accidentally summoned Zach Baggins and just took a while to take effect?
It took a while for him to show up. And based on our commitment to that project, Zach Baggins would be the quality of demon I think a bunch of drunk freshman college students would summon.
Yeah, I know we're joking, and a lot of people take this very, very seriously.
I know, absolutely.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
There is so much in our universe that remains hidden. Until now. My name is Kristen Seavey, and I have some stories that you might want to hear on the podcast, The Hidden Staircase. Whether it's true crime, paranormal occurrences, or perhaps something beyond the stars, I keep all their stories safe in my library. So come with me down the staircase, pull up a chair, and let's discover the enigmas that remain hidden from us all. Listen to The Hidden Staircase now, wherever you get podcasts.
So let's talk a little bit about the way that grimoires are viewed in particular fields or in belief systems. So this will be bulleted a little bit. So let's don't dig too deep in these, but maybe it'll open up some additional threads of discussion. So first of all, spell books as used by cunning folk in medieval Europe. How did that play out?
I am fascinated by the Anglo-Saxon leech books and the books that came across lately. I think, don't quote me, but I think either the University of Sheffield or one of those sort of second tier is the wrong word, but non-Oxbridge universities in England have actually taken some of those leech books and actually found that some of the formulas in there work. Some of the antibiotic properties of the poultices and boluses that are in there, they have actually discovered actually do what they're supposed to do. And they're nestled up right next to bizarre magical incantations that deal with fairy lore and other practices of sympathetic magic. So I think the idea was that medicine was very primitive until essentially the 20th century. I mean, you know, until germ theory was developed, we really could only hit or miss at what, you know, was the underlying cause of disease. I think it was 1920 or 1921 before contagious disease was finally the second number one cause of death in the United States after the Spanish flu and other forms of disease started to take their place. Nobody dies of contagious disease hardly anymore unless they're old or have an immune system problem. So the idea that you could put some root or mushroom or something in your body and fix yourself was pretty powerful connotation. So I think this tradition of cunning people developed around that kind of tradition. I mean, I suffered terribly from bronchitis whenever I was a kid, and it was my aunt who was an admitted cunning woman who told me that I should use eucalyptus as a way to treat bronchitis instead of the medicines that I was taking. And, you know, she was always blessing my shoes and, you know, gave me a rope belt to wear that would guarantee prosperity. And I mean, she knew how to use tobacco to cure stomach upset and all these different things. And, you know, stomach upset in those days was worms, and the tobacco juice would purge a body of worms. So I think there was this tradition of cunning, quote unquote, magic that was really sort of folk remedy, folk medicine and folk magic that had been passed down. Now, we had a scholar whose name was Margaret Murray, who sort of, I think, in retrospect, misinterpreted that as what she called the witch cult in Europe. She wrote this famous book called The Witch Cult in Europe, where she determined through her anthropological research that a folk tradition of witchcraft and magic had persisted in Europe that had, you know, sort of survived the introduction of Christianity into England specifically, but mostly in Western Europe. Yeah, that book came out in 1921. It was called The Witch Cult in Western Europe. It's been heavily panned now, but I don't think it was entirely wrong. I think there were some folk magic traditions that survived in British Isles, in Western Europe, that migrated to places like Appalachia, the American South, the Pennsylvania Dutch region, and because of the isolated nature of those places, survived. And, you know, that tradition goes back way on back, especially if you look at some of these leech books from the Anglo-Saxon period. Some of the spells and cures in them are identical to what you would find in The Long Lost Friend, which is essentially a 19th century manuscript.
Let's talk about that for a minute. The spell books of the Pennsylvania Dutch Hexameisters.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, that is what I'm working on right now. When we moved to Washington, D.C. about 9 years ago, you know, York County, which is right across the border, like, you know, I call it the York Triangle. Maybe I'll write a book called that, so don't take that from me, Blake.
I won't steal it.
is one of these areas that people ascribe a lot of high strangeness. The Seven Gates of Hell, the famous Seven Gates of Hell are there, and they have a weird Bigfoot tradition out at this place called Chickie's Rock, called the Albatwitch. And, you know, there's one of my very dear friends that I've met there in York is a dyed-in-the-wool Bigfoot hunter, and he has his own podcast, and we talk about this stuff a lot, you know, me from the skeptical perspective. And so York County, Adams County, and Lancaster County there in Pennsylvania have this rich tradition of Pennsylvania folk magic that comes from the Mennonites and the Amish that immigrated there in the 19th century. And one of those is the concept of Hexenmeistery. Hexenmeister, that basically just translates into English as witch. And they based their religious tradition or their magical tradition on the 6th and 7th book of Solomon, or excuse me, of Moses. And the reason why I got into that is because that's the same book that, you know, my great-grandfather and my aunt used to do their magical rituals. So, you know, whenever I discovered that there was this connection between the Tennessee River Valley and the Pennsylvania Dutch, I got super excited about it. And what's famous about York County is it's the place where in the early 19th century we had the last great sort of witch trial in American history. A guy named John Blymeyer, who was a Hexenmeister, was killed by a guy he supposedly put a hex on. And if you go back and look at the German language newspapers from that time period in York and Lancaster County, you know, Hexenmeisters were openly advertising their wares in the paper. The most famous was a woman who is known to us as the River Witch of Marietta, and she supposedly is the person who outed, you know, John Blymeyer as an evil magician. He lived in a place that we now know as Hex Hollow. It was called Blymeyer's Hollow in the old days. It's still a super creepy spot to go, and there's all kinds of weird lore about it. And, you know, it looks just like it did in the 1700s. His house is still there. His family's preserved it like it happened yesterday. But, you know, basically he was a guy who supposedly used his grimoire, which in this case was The Long Lost Friend or the Powwow book, to put a hex on some folks, and one of his alleged victims came to his place, beat him to death, burned his book. The family has preserved even the spot on the floor where his book was burned. The murderer was tried and sentenced, and that forced sort of the Hexenmeistery tradition in York and Lancaster counties to go underground. But I know people in York County that still consider themselves Hexenmeisters. I mean, you don't have to. I mean, you drink in enough German bars there, and you'll meet some of these folks after a little while. And I mean, this tradition is a main line back, you know, to 10th century Germany. And I find that incredibly exciting. And I find it a little bit sad because there's, you know, because it's so outside the purview of what legitimate scholars find interesting now, that nobody's really up there collecting those stories. It's up to the, you know, the paranormal investigators to do this now, and I'm not entirely convinced they're equipped to do it.
So just for pronunciation, is John Blymeyer believed he had been cursed by Nelson, was it Reimeyer?
Reimeyer. No, yeah.
Okay.
That's correct. Sorry, I got that backwards. It was John Blymeyer that believed he had been cursed. He believed he had been cursed by Nelson Reimeyer, who lived in Hex Hollow, which we knew as Raymire's Hollow. Yeah, Blymire, Raymire. There's a lot of that.
It's,
going
like,
on.
It's a quagmire. Yeah.
It's a quagmire, yeah, of Myers.
That's funny. But it's a very serious case, though. It was like quite a big story in the newspapers at the time.
It was huge. I mean, if you go to the Library of Congress's sort of open source newspaper thing and put in York County, you know, quote, witch, you'll get hundreds of stories. It was a nationwide story.
And it had a big impact on the Hexenmeister cultural community, right?
It disappeared overnight. It went underground. I mean, you can find, if you go to the York County Historical Society, you can find pictures of old businesses where people were advertising Hexenmeistery in the windows of shops, you know, on the main street in York, on Queen Street and King Street. And in overnight, it went completely underground. But it's still there. I mean, you go, I know of one palmistrist in the north part of York County that is a Hexenmeister. I mean, you go in and talk to her, and that's what
she
does.
So hopping all over the place again, let's talk about spell books within esoteric orders. Like I'm thinking here about things like Thelema or Golden Dawn.
Sure, absolutely. I've actually got right here the ginormous, I know you can't see this, this is one of my favorite books in the world, the complete Golden Dawn System of Magic by Israel Rigardi. And if anybody ever breaks into my house, this will be the book I use as a bulletproof vest. It's about 6 inches thick. And, I mean, it is the complete compendium. It's an 8-volume set in one volume, a complete compendium of all of essentially the Golden Dawn's magical rituals. And this reads like the grimoire that you want to read as a Dungeons and Dragons player or as a fan of Lovecraft or M.R. James. If you can imagine a grimoire in your mind, this would be the book. It's got all the great stuff, you know, all the great rituals. They're very pompously written. They summon demons, they summon angels. You know, it's one of those things, you know, it's almost like a cult pornography. You know, open any page and point to something and you'll get something beautiful. Here's one. In the name of the Lord of the universe and by command of the very honored Hierophant, hear all ye that I proclaim that name of the aspirant will hereafter be known unto you by the motto XYZ has been admitted in due form to the neophyte grade of the Order of the Golden Dawn in the outer. And everyone claps their hands. I mean, it's just this beautifully written nonsense, but it is the grimoire that late 19th century people wanted to read. It's their Necronomicon. And, you know, obviously the Masons have their own rituals that they use that are all based on those kinds of ancient texts, or at least what Albert Pike interpreted to be ancient texts. He was sort of the father of ritual magic in Scottish Rite Masonry. And the Ordo Templis Orientis, the Golden Dawn, Thelema, Crowley had an amazing amount of influence in all of those. He was an extremely gifted writer, even if he was an extremely notorious son of a bitch. Came up with just some beautiful rituals, but the reality is they're all modern. I mean, they're based on what these guys thought was channeled wisdom from the ancients. The greatest gift that Helena Blavatsky gave to the world was the idea that you did not need ancient texts to transmit ancient wisdom, that Gnosticism was still valuable, it was still real, and if you got yourself into the right kind of mindset, you could channel an ancient text from the secret masters yourself, and you didn't have to go to some lost library in Poland, you know, to find an ancient text. And I think that is sort of a gap between the mysticism of the ancients, the early 19th century, and the mysticism of the 20th century and 21st century, which I would largely categorize as chaos magic, which is this idea that, you know, magic doesn't have to work for it to work. Does that make sense? Like a chaos magician, somebody in the tradition of Jack Parsons or Israel Rigardi or Kenneth Anger, the filmmaker, believe that the ritual itself is not important. It's the fact that you're doing the ritual, that you're saying the words, and that you believe it. You're sort of creating the reality you want, like a tulpa almost, through your will and through your psychic force. So you don't have to have a 10th century Arabic manuscript handed down to you in Latin in order to get all the money and chicks and film rights you want, you just have to have your will channeled through the ritual in order to pull it off. So I think that's what's so beautiful about these kind of things that people like Crowley were doing, is they were turning the magic that they had inherited from their predecessors into something that was almost akin to a Nietzschean will to power. We just have to put on the costume. We just have to say the words, and we have to channel our force of will into it in order to get the stuff that we want.
Yeah, that's actually, we talked about that in the Slenderman episode. We talked with Joe Laycock and Natasha Mickles. They've since become married, but she talked about the idea of tulpas within Buddhism as opposed to how it had been sort of bastardized by the...
Completely misinterpreted. Yeah. But absolutely.
I think that's fascinating, the theosophy, the way it's had an impact on so many aspects of the paranormal, way it's viewed in Western culture. For something that most people don't even know about, it's had a really outsized footprint on the whole field.
You know, I would argue that the stuff that we talk about as magic today, the occult, the esoteric, those concepts are about 125 years old, and they come almost exclusively out of theosophy. I mean, we all think of the magus or the magus as the guy on the Rider-Waite tarot deck with, you know, one hand pointed to the heavens and another hand pointed to the ground with the infinity symbol over his head and the tools of his trade laid out before him, you know, as this kind of character that can, you know, manipulate the environment using these esoteric forces. Prior to theosophy, I'm not sure that was the way people looked at magic. And in fact, prior to that introduction of the later tarot decks, there was no magus in the card. The character that was the magus was actually the mountebank, the fraud, the gamester. So in many ways, medieval people, late Renaissance people, had a more skeptical view of pure magic than we do now. Magic and science were completely integrated in everybody's worldview, but there wasn't a magician. There wasn't a magus. Magic was just a thing you did. And post theosophy, it became a separate reality that people now practice. I mean, you know, if you sat down with your accountant and he gave you a bunch of advice on how to invest your 401k and your 403b and then said, yeah, you know, after work tonight, I'm going to go practice a little ritual magic, you probably wouldn't write him a check. But in the old days, you know, everybody did magic. It was a technology just like anything else.
Yeah, I think viewing it as a technology is an interesting approach, because I think before, as we mentioned before science really came along as a filter, a lot of these things were just as good, right? Everything was just as good.
Yeah, just as good. Try it, take chances.
Right, exactly. One more is, this one's kind of interesting to me, is the spell books as viewed by Wicca and neo-paganism.
I think this might go a little bit to one of our other conversations. The great unfortunate reality of Wicca is that it so desperately wants an ancient tradition. And the bad news is that people in Western Europe didn't write down their ancient traditions. So, you know, I have a lot of friends that are Wiccans, you know, and they're all some of the most beautiful people I've ever known. You know, they don't have the anxiety that I have. They don't have the moral problems that I have. You know, they have a lot more clarity than most of my Christian friends because they found something that works for them. And I think the endorphins they get from the rituals they do are probably pretty damn sweet. The bad news is that Wicca is essentially a late 19th century, early 20th century tradition, because the historical roots that it wants to have don't come down to us from the time in the past. So it's been on them to create those rituals for themselves. They have a vague notion that it's an idea of goddess worship, an idea of lunar worship. It very much elevates the feminine to the forefront rather than the masculine of the kind of religions from the Levant. It's very much about harmony with nature, which makes perfect sense in the world we live in now, where we're so out of harmony with nature. I think it's an attempt to correct that balance. So a lot of what you get in Wicca are essentially modern versions of the old spell books that would have been created as a part of nature magic. And I think it's a real attempt to preserve that. You know, I have a good friend who I'll plug here who edits a magazine called Luna Luna, which you can find online, which publishes Wiccan spells, and they're beautiful. They're often written by poets, poetesses, and they are meant to be these life-affirming rituals. And in no way are they meant to actually carry out the thing that you want. In many ways, I think they almost take the place of psychotherapy. It's a way to put your mind right through this ritual process. Masonry does that. Whenever I was participating in some Thelemite rituals, you know, 20 years ago, that's essentially what we were doing. We were trying to engage in sort of self-perfection, not sympathetic magic. It's unfortunate. I mean, one of the great losses is that we don't know what ancient Western European religious practice was, and that's what Wicca is trying to achieve. Again, that's a gift that I think Theosophy has given to us, this idea that we can invent from whole cloth an ancient tradition that is still rooted in ancient tradition.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's also the this Levian Satanism,
yeah,
which was kind of an atheistic Satanism. I mean, like, it's not as diabolic as I imagine most people want to believe it is. There's a huge section of Judeo-Christians who would view Satanism as obviously evil, but that's not the satanic people of Levian strain. They tend to be almost like mocking, but yet they still contain ritual magic as a psychodrama. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, that's what it is. And this comes out of that sort of Kenneth Anger, Jack Parsons, Aleister Crowley tradition of what I'll call chaos magic, though not everybody would apply it to that. But that comes from, you know, one of the big things about the spiritualist movement in the 19th century is that it came up with this sort of what we might call word of faith or faith word tradition that we most associate now with Robert Tilton, the minister from my hometown in Dallas, who actually had a ministry called Word of Faith. But it was based on this principle of animal magnetism, which we find recycled essentially all the time. The Secret is based on this principle, that series of books. And it's the idea, if you think good thoughts, if you do good things, if you visualize in your mind the thing that you want, you'll draw those things to you. If you think negative thoughts or bad thoughts, then you'll draw those things to you. And Anton LaVey very much adopted that worldview. The idea was, look, if I see myself as a powerful person, if I pose as a powerful person and project an illusion of power and control, then that will be reality.
If that were true, wouldn't most 17-year-old boys be surrounded by hot women?
If it were true, yeah. But I mean, again, the thing but I mean, you know, create your own. I mean, Ready Player One, right? You create your own reality the way you want it to be. And Anton LaVey embraced that full tilt boogie. So did Kenneth Anger. So did a lot of these guys. And that's what I mean, the Church of Satan, you're right, it is atheistic Satanism. If you read their basic commandments, I think they're more appealing than the commandments found in Deuteronomy. They're all about, hey, man, you don't come on my property unless you ask. You don't make a sexual advance unless you're asked. You just need to be chill, bro. I mean, they're very appealing, but because they're couched inside that transitive, unappealing universe of Satanism, I think a lot of people find it to be something they have to reject. I mean,
is it diabolic libertarianism? Is that?
I think diabolic libertarianism sounds great.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not a libertarian, so I'm not going to tell that line. But a lot of stuff that the Satanists do, I mean, they stand up for free speech, individual rights, no sexual harassment. I mean, look at what they spend their money on, you know, trying to keep open spaces free for dialogue. I mean, it ain't that bad. It's just that the thing that people hang up on is this idea that it's connected to Satan. That being said, how much of Satan is actually in the Bible? Most of what we know about Satan comes from John Milton, right? I mean, Paradise Lost, Paradise Found. Satan is a lawyer in the Bible and in the Quran. He's not a force for any kind of negativity. Everything we know about Satan as a negative force comes from esoterica and books outside.
Yeah, it's metatext, exactly. We talk about that. We actually did an episode on the devil, and it's a
Right.
I think, now, to be fair, many people, their view of religion is built on what they're taught via the culture of the church, not through the texts of the church. So
many people, yeah. I think you mean pretty much
everybody. Yeah. Like most people don't read the Bible. And even if they do, they don't read the context of how it was written because they view it as a single book rather than a collection of books built over time.
And that's exactly true. So, yeah, but ritual magic is a huge part of modern occultism, whether it's the, you know, the ritual that makes you a Blue Lodge Mason, a Master Mason, a member of the Church of Satan, you know, any of these things. And I think those are about forming community. The idea that you have to learn something that nobody else knows, that you have a secret that nobody else knows, that you, you know, have hand signs and costumes that you wear in order to preserve this identity and this information is very appealing. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I mean, this is true in the military and in government. Like most top secret, quote unquote, information is boring as hell. But there's all these rituals you go through to have to preserve it, and you have words that you use, and you know you have genuflections you have to perform in order to get access to it. I mean, control of information is extremely powerful on the one hand, but it's also extremely binding in terms of creating a community. You know, any on the History Channel who wants to talk about space aliens, the first thing out of his mouth is, when I was in the Navy, I had above top secret clearance. No, you didn't, because there is no such thing as above top secret clearance. It's top secret, SCI, compartmentalized information. There's no higher clearance than top secret. And anybody that had TSSCI knows that. So you immediately know that that guy was lying. but the reality is that is a way to say, I have something that you don't have. And I'm a part of this community that you're not a part of. And whether we're talking about the Mithraicists of, you know, first and second century Rome, or, you know, the modern Satanists, the modern Freemasons, these guys, that's what they got. They've got an esoteric secret that they've got hold of, that they're in control of. And it's a powerful tool for creating community.
Well, I'm reminded of when I was in the Navy, I was in the Naval Nuclear Power Program. And
where were you stationed at? Were you out at?
I was in Orlando. Yeah.
Orlando. So,
So when I was in Nuclear Field A school, I used to go jogging around the Orlando area. And one day when I was jogging, I jogged and there was a college behind the campus. I don't remember the name of the college. I have to look it up. But the I jogged over to the campus and I was like, oh, look, they have a library. So I walked into the library, and in the library, in the entrance to the library, they had like a little display and they had a book. And that book had it was all about nuclear power. And the amazing thing was, like, for me to, like, go check out my books to just do my regular A-school studies, we had to have top-secret clearance, and we had to, like, you know, check out our books and check in our books in compliance with Naval Security Protocol. And then in the entrance to the library was this book that had, like, a layout of a nuclear power plant that was far more detailed than anything in our textbooks. And it was just, if you walked into the school, there it was. It's like, so some of this compartmentalization of secrecy is entirely about the sort of the protocol, but not initially about the content. So that's really
it's
interesting.
It's designed to teach you that it's important, right? So that you're always on, like, you know, that anybody can Google this, but, you know, access to nuclear basing and construction plans is called Q clearance, and it's managed by the Department of Energy, you know, not the Department of Defense or the intelligence community, and they guard it very heavily. And, you know, people who have Q clearance are allowed to see, you know, things that people who just have regular top secret clearance aren't allowed to see. Again, this isn't classified. You can get it off Google, but it really is about the access to the information. And I don't want to reduce, you know, ritual magic to, you know, topics of national security. But in a world where ritual magic was power, I mean, how different is that from nuclear energy? I mean, most people, I mean, as ritual magic and nuclear energy might as well be the same thing in terms of the, you know, the ability of the individual person to interpret how it actually works. I don't know how a nuclear bomb works, and I've had graduate level physics classes. You know, I mean, That's just the reality of it. On the surface, some of this technology looks like magic, and it's powerful in its in both its intent and its and in its need for secrecy. So we have a long history of keeping things occult or secret or hidden, and a lot of these textbooks are just a way of sort of doing that.
This is awesome. I the amazing thing is we still have I've got several more episodes based on magic that I want to get to.
Sure.
But it does have an interesting tie-in to monsters. I mean, there's so much of basic monster lore that involves using magic to maintain control or summon monsters. And,
sure. Golems, especially golems, the monster summoned from a Kabbalistic magical tradition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, tons of that stuff where you could make yourself a little helper or a big helper out of clay and invest them with the power of the Word of God and get them to move around. Yeah, the...
We talked about homunculi in one
homunculi,
of our episodes.
Yeah.
My favorite pun of the series is the title episode of our homunculus episode was...
That was Onan the Jar...
Onan the Jar Burying. It really ties a lot of stuff together. Oh my God,
yeah,
I'm easily amused.
That's exactly right. I would argue, man, one of the things that really bugs me is, you know, before the show we talked a little bit about the old out listservs from the BBS days. Like, you'll run into these UFO guys who are like, look, man, I believe in space aliens, but Bigfoot's bullshit. And it's like, okay, this is all part of a sort of unified field theory of sort of you know occultism. Prior to the Enlightenment, all this everything was on the table. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Principles of the properties of light, alchemy, Bigfoot, sea monsters. All that stuff was a part of the human experience. And in the recent years, we've decided to compartmentalize this stuff. Based on, you know, these discrete ideas that some of this stuff is objectively, factually real and some of it isn't. But for a lot of people, and I think this might be a big problem in our society, determining what's objectively, factually real and what isn't is still kind of a problem. But I'm not on my soapbox about that because we haven't had enough time yet. It's only been 125 to 250 years since we decided that these two universes need to exist separately.
Well, one of the interesting things to me is when you view things as technology, I mean, I'm working on a book on technology, and so this is kind of near and dear to my heart, but all of it has an evolutionary aspect. So like the natural selection theory of Darwin works on these ideas as well. So if you take the idea that that Richard Dawkins' concept of mimetics might be a viable way of viewing information sharing, right? And
correct.
Then you look at technology as a way of providing a natural selection application to that. So anything that can be copied and can mutate and then has selective forces acting on it could, in a sense, be viewed as a natural selection process, right? And so I believe effectively... technologies that we use, the ones that actually work, are actually the product of an evolutionary process. And so I don't think that's figurative. I think it's literal. I think that these sort of come to the – like the process of innovation in technology is not an entirely artificial process. I think that it's sort of subjected to these sort of natural laws. So
absolutely. I mean, we got telephone at the time in human history when telephone was viable. You know, the Greeks didn't build telephone because they didn't have wiring.
Exactly. But that concept of the adjacent next, that's a really useful idea that
exactly.
when the technology has reached the point that the elements are available, it will appear whether you want it to or not.
As soon as you speak it, it will appear. You know, someone said human cloning 50 years ago. Once that word was uttered, human cloning is almost an inevitability.
It's an inevitability. It is an inevitability because sooner or later somebody's going
to
do it.
So this is the question, Jerry, that we like to ask all of our guests. What's your favorite monster?
It's reptoids. The good old David Icke reptoids.
Oh, David Icke style, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Oh, interesting. We haven't had that before.
Well, I am one. That's why. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So I was – one of my jobs when I first came to the State Department, I was United States Treaty Archivist, and I did that for 2 years. And I got a call one day from an English guy. I'm I don't want to get sued, so I'm not going to say who it was, who wanted the treaty between Eisenhower and the gray aliens. Your listeners will be familiar with this. Some people call it the Grenada Treaty, the Guayarda Treaty. It has all kinds of different names. Basically, Ike was not president for a couple of days while he was having a cancer removed. And that's supposedly when the Greys made their famous treaty with us. And I had to inform this English caller that I did not have that treaty in the archive because it did not exist. And it was a bunch of horseshit. So after about a 2-hour conversation, I was blatantly accused of being in on it all and a part of the conspiracy. So
obviously,
just decided to own it. I'm a reptoid, so they're my favorite monster.
Yeah, we've never interviewed a reptoid before.
Yeah.
There you go. I hope I've got the occult knowledge nailed down. I've fully outed myself on this episode.
A couple of clarifications. We're saying gray aliens, not gray aliens.
If we were on the Art Bell show, it would definitely be gray aliens, Blake.
What was the other one? We're talking about Ike, the president. But we're also mentioning
David Icke, the conspiracy theorist, have been the guy I talked to on the phone.
Yeah, just for clarification, right? That David Icke was never our president, to the best of my knowledge, right? So,
Who knows?
At least not in this reality. Maybe in Chimerica, he is our president.
Yeah, it could be. Good point. I know one thing. I also love the color turquoise, and he's missing a huge opportunity to raise his army of followers as Turk warriors.
So this is going to cement my cred as a reptoid. I am tritanopic. I am cyan blind. I cannot see turquoise.
Well, if you were at my house, you would, because it's everywhere. But
to me, it looks like a sick, sad gray color, and aww, it's a big problem in my relationship with my wife over
that
the color.
That is a heartbreaker.
Oh,
it really is. Yeah.
We just got a new kitten, and I named her Cyan because that's what color I thought she was. And everybody's like, dude, cats don't come in that color. And I'm like, I'm sorry. That's what color that cat is.
That's such a pretty name anyway.
So David Icke's shirt ain't going to work on me, man. I'm on top of him.
That is amazing.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard part two of our two-part coverage of Grimoires with Jerry Drake. We appreciate Jerry's hard work with the State Department, but do hope he's someday able to publish more of his magic, legends, and monster research. And when he does, hopefully you'll hear about it here on Monster Talk. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed here on this show are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily represent the views of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for taking the time to listen to this program. We really appreciate it.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
You know, how, let's do it this way. When Blake Smith, when a human being does X, Y, and Z, they end up buying flowers for their wife because they pissed her off.
Actually, that was the next place I was going was, how can I predict whether I'm going to be or not? That's,
correct. So, so I think this is one of the things that really underlies where we're going in the national security state. If I can put together...
If more people in the State Department are concerned about me being, I am very excited about it, my tax dollars at work.